Well, I want to welcome you to our church. If you're new, I want to introduce myself. My name's Tim. I'm the lead pastor here, and we are in a really important conversation right now. We started this last week, a series, talking all things mental health. And here's what we notice, okay? In our society, for the last maybe decade, even the last few years, there has been an incredible uptick, an increase in all forms of mental health struggles and pain and mental illness. We have seen a massive increase in anxiety and depression, suicidal thoughts, and all forms of mental illness. And I just felt like it was something that we need to talk about. And so we're taking our time and we're going to work through this. And it's a conversation that I think affects us all. We noticed that from our own survey within our church. Whether you're someone who struggles with it or you know someone, I promise that covers all of us. And here's the thing about mental health is that it is complex, right? There's so many different buckets. We talked about last week all the different categories of where mental, different levels of mental illness and mental health struggle comes from. There's some that's biological and some that's more clinical and some that it's situational. But here's what I know. It affects all of us and it reaches all of us. I was actually a little bit overwhelmed last week as we began this talk. I was overwhelmed by the number of people that came up to me and just began to share their experience, their journey with mental health struggle. And it really reminded me that this is a weight that so many of us carry, that this is a reality, that we all wrestle with this from time to time. And I think the ultimate reason for that is because we live in a broken world. I think whether you believe in God or not, doesn't matter. If you just watch the news, if you read the headlines, you'll recognize that our world it's just filled with pain, it's filled with struggle, it's filled with heartache, and life is that way. And all of us are living through a broken human experience. And because of that, it creates pain. It creates all kinds of pain, and so many of us are experiencing that. And I want to talk today about what we do with our emotional pain. What do we do with our mental and our emotional pain? Because it is a reality, and we all wrestle with it. Listen, even if you're not someone who for years has battled this or you're on medication, can I just say this? All of us will go through seasons. We'll go through situations. We'll deal with the dark night of the soul. And the question isn't whether or not you or I will experience emotional pain. The question is, what will you do with your emotional pain? That's the real question. In fact, I want to just ask this blanket question. What do you do when you have pain? What do you do when you feel pain? Like, what do you do? Let me just simplify this in a physical level. What do you do when you have a headache or a toothache? Here's what I know most of us do. We reach for a bottle of ibuprofen, right? Give me some Tylenol. Give me some ibuprofen. You know, you can double them up. You can space them out. This is what most of us do when we have a pain, when we have an ache, right? We reach for something to medicate, to alleviate the pain. That's just natural, right? I will say this. I am a terrible medicine taker. I don't know if any of you are really bad at taking medicine, but I think it comes from my childhood. For the longest time, I could not swallow pills. I had some kind of mental block. I would chew food and swallow it much bigger than a little itty-bitty pill, but stick a pill in my mouth and I'm like gagging it out. I could not get it down. And so I think because of that, through most of my childhood, I just kind of learned to sit with my pain. I just dealt with it because I couldn't take medicine. Now I'm an adult and I can take pills, but I'm terrible at it. I'll have a headache and I'll bad headache all day long, and I'll get home and I'll see my wife, and this is what I do when you're aching. What do? You gotta have someone to tell. You know, you want a little empathy, you want a little love, you want a little support. And so I'll tell my wife, like, oh, I've had the worst headache all day. It's been throbbing, it's so painful, it's just been so terrible. And you know what my wife says to me whenever I say that? She said, did you take anything for it? And I'm like, well, no. And you know what she says after that? She says, well, don't complain to me if you're not going to take some medicine. Such a loving wife, isn't she? So empathetic, so caring and compassionate. Oh, by the way, she's a nurse. You know what I found about nurse? If you know someone in the medical profession, you know what I found? They are incredibly compassionate toward their patients, not so much toward their family. Hello, that's my reality. What do you do when you... you have pain. Well, here's what we do. We reach for something because, listen, somewhere inside of all of us, I think it's innate. We don't think about it consciously. But something inside of us just, we'll do whatever we can to get away from pain. It's our instinct. I just want the pain to go away. Honestly, that instinct has really undergirded some basic human philosophy for thousands of years. There's a guy who really kind of started an entire school of philosophy. He was a student of Socrates, so this is in 4th century BC. And a guy by the name of Aristippus of Cyrene. In fact, I'll show you this. He lived from 435 to 365 BC. So this is a long time ago. And there was an entire school of philosophy that he started, the Cyrenaic school of philosophy, around one basic concept. It was what he believed was the primary driver of all human behavior. It was two primary things that he would say, I think this is what motivates all of us, kind of almost on an animalistic level. And this is kind of, it's this idea of hedonism. You ever heard of the term? How many of you ever heard of the term hedonism? Okay, you probably heard that term. He actually kind of created this philosophy school, and then you had Epicurus and Epicureans that kind of followed suit. But let me give you what really the essence of hedonism is. Hedonism is really this. It's this thought that we are all about pursuing pleasure and avoiding pain. That if you were to boil all of human behavior down, maybe even the goal of life, it's to pursue pleasure and to avoid pain at all costs. And he says that this is how we're wired. It's funny because even if you've never even heard of this term before, you can probably think about life and you think about our world and you think about your life and you probably go, you know, I think I do that. Most of us do. If something feels good, we move toward it. If something hurts us, we get away from it. And I believe that this is there for a reason. That there's something instinctual in all of us. You should understand that. There's something in your brain that is there, that's wired there, that will help you protect yourself from pain. You know we do that, right? We learn to protect ourselves, to shield ourselves from pain. Whatever's painful, I'm going to move away from it. And if we can't get away from the pain, here's what we'll do. We'll turn to something of pleasure to fill the pain. That's what we do. One of two things. Pursue pleasure and avoid pain. If I can't avoid the pain, I'll turn to pleasure. Let me show you how this works. You ever been stressed? Yeah, I know you have. What do you do when you get stressed? You know what a lot of us do when we get stressed? Eat. Stress eating. We overeat. And we don't care about the diet when you are stressed, right? The only thing you want, give me a couple bags of chips, maybe a full container of Oreos. That is some good medication for my soul when I'm stressed, right? This is what we do. What I'm saying is that we will run to things that will provide some type of pleasure because we are feeling the pain. And we want to get away from it. This is why some people turn to a few drinks in the evening. Because it helps me unwind. And it helps me kind of just feel chill because I'm so stressed and my life is this. This is why sometimes we'll binge watch TV. This is sometimes why we don't want to do anything except play video games. It's because what we're doing is we have something in our life that's creating stress or anxiety or depression or despair, and we don't know how to deal with it. And so here's what we do. When our emotional pain is out of order, we don't know how to medicate it, we turn to something of pleasure. Now, here's the thing we all need to understand. We're all built different. Like, there are things that you love and enjoy that I don't. There are things that I love and enjoy that you don't. The reality is that we're all built differently. We're wired different. And here's what that means. That means we all self-medicate differently. You know what I'm talking about, where we write ourselves as the doctor of your life. You write yourself a prescription of what you need when you're hurting. And we all have our own way of escaping pain because we're all different. And so let me ask you a question. And I want us all to contemplate this because I think it's real easy for us to think, no, it's not me, and you must be talking about somebody else. No, all of us. I want to ask you, what do you do in a difficult season? What do you do when you feel the stress, when you feel overwhelmed, when you feel the pain? Here's what I want to ask. What is your escape? What's your escape? I want you to think about that. What is your go-to? What is the thing that you run toward because it makes you feel good or it comforts you? It makes you feel good. It could be work, right? Like when your home life is a mess, when your marriage isn't good, some people, you know what they do? I'll disconnect here because I don't want to relive the pain. I don't want to experience it or think about it. So I will throw myself into my job, my career. Maybe I can be successful at work. It'll help me make up for feeling like a failure at home. And so we throw ourselves into something else. I'm asking you, what's your escape? Because we all have them. And they're different for all of us, right? For some, it could be work. Others, it could be sex or pornography. We run to it because, and maybe it's because of something that happened to you. Maybe because you were abused sexually, you don't know how to process or deal with the pain. And the ironic part is so many people who are abused end up running into some other sex addiction or pornography because they just don't know what to do with the pain of their inner world. What is it? What is it? Could be smoking. You need it to relieve your stress. It could be eating. You overeat and you eat the wrong things. It could be social media. Social media is entertaining, right? It's also an escape. It's also when you can just spend hours and hours just scrolling and you never get to the bottom of it. And what happens is a lot of times we do not love our reality, so we'd rather live in a false reality, a meta reality, someone else's world. We want to live through their experiences because we're miserable in our situation right now. And it becomes an escape. For some, it's isolation. What's your escape? For some, when your world, your inner world, your outer world's a mess, you just pull back from everybody. My escape is I'm going to just become a recluse, and I'm going to sit inside my space, my safe space, and I'm not going to let anybody in. What is it? What is your escape? It could be alcohol. I know you don't have a problem, but I'm just saying it could be that you need alcohol to really help you unwind because your life is so stressful. You're dealing with loss, or you just went through a divorce, or and you don't really know how to cope, and so you do that. It could be drugs. It could be edibles. It could be marijuana. It could be something that helps you chill. It could be a stronger drug because you need to feel something because you don't feel anything because the pain is so overwhelming. What is your escape? You know, as I've kind of really gone through a process of getting to know my own soul, one of the things I began to notice is that for me, one of my escapes is distraction. One of my escapes is that I veg. That's an escape. I don't mean I eat veggies. I mean I veg. I become a vegetable. You know what I'm talking about? Like I literally, like come home from work and I just want to plop down on the couch and I want to watch any kind of just mind-numbing TV, it doesn't matter, for hours on end, and it's a way for me to disconnect, disassociate with what I'm really struggling with, and I'm not productive, and I don't want to do anything at all, and all I want, I'm just exhausted and tired, and I should get sleep, but I stay up way too late because I just don't, I begin to pay attention and realize, oh, that's an escape for me. And listen, all these things, a lot of these things aren't bad things in and of themselves. They're not. They're things, some of them are things that we need. Some of them things that we do. But what happens is that whenever you turn to something, not just to relieve stress, I'm not talking about that. I know you got a hobby, you got this, we need workout, all those things are good. But when it moves beyond just relieving stress to actually becoming an escape, it gets dangerous. Here's what happens. Is over time, when you keep repeating that, you build a dependency in your life for it. I need this to manage, to cope. And whenever you develop a codependency for something, you are on the path toward an addiction. It's an addiction. You are needing that. You know, here's the thing when it comes to addictions. I've never met anyone who sets out intentionally to be an addict of anything. I've never met someone who's like, you know, I'm just trying to become a porn addict because it's something I aspire to. Nobody. Nobody says I want to be an alcoholic. Nobody says I want to be addicted to heroin. Nobody. It's not on our radar. What we're doing most of the time, listen, is that we're just escaping. I don't know what to do with the pain of my inner world or my outer world. And so I'm just going to run to the thing that brings pleasure because I don't know how to get rid of the pain. And it ends up messing us up. In fact, I want to allow scripture just one particular powerful verse from the Apostle Paul in 1 Corinthians chapter 6. And this is a verse that I think is so important to understand and draw the principle out of it when it comes to our lives. But I want to allow scripture just speak to us when it comes to the things that we run to. Here's what the Apostle Paul said. He's in quotes. He's quoting someone hypothetically. He says, I have the right to do anything, you say. It's like, I can do whatever I want. I live my life however I want. Yeah, okay, you do. I have the right to do anything, you say. But not everything is what? Can we all say this word out loud? Not everything is beneficial, right? You can do anything. You can eat as many bags of potato chips as you want. You can. Can we all agree that's probably not beneficial for your arteries, your waistline, any of that stuff, even your mental health, right? Okay, you have the right to do anything. He says, but not everything is beneficial. Then he repeats it again. All right, let's say this again. I have the right to do anything. I know you do. But here's where this is important. He says, I will not be what? Everybody say this. I will not be, come on, say it again. I will not be mastered by anything. This is a really important truth that we need to get today. Now, in context, what Paul is really speaking to is the fact that there's freedom in following Christ. And that is so beautiful. I love that because when he's speaking this, he's speaking to people who grew up with a system of laws and rules that were so overwhelming, they were impossible to follow. You know, I found that sometimes people think that's what church is. They think church is just a bunch of rules, and if you don't do these things and you do these things, then God will be happy with you and life will be good. No, that's not what it is. God's intent for us was simple. In fact, Jesus came and he said, can I clarify? Just clarify a few things. If you want to know how to really live this life the way God intends, love God with everything, your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and love your neighbors yourself. If you would just do those things, you're good. You don't have to worry about, hey, don't touch this and don't taste that and don't eat this and don't do that. You just do those things. That's all you need to do. But here's the thing. There are a lot of things Paul recognizes, and you can apply this principle across the board. There's a lot of things that are fine. They're legal. You can play games all day, all night in your house. You're not breaking one law, right? You can eat as much food as you want. You can drink as much alcohol as long as you do it in a safe environment. You're not driving. You're not impaired doing stuff. I mean, there's things that you can do, but Paul wants to remind us, not everything's good for you. And oh, by the way, here's where you know your escape has crossed the line, is when you need it just to survive. When you need something to escape, it becomes your master. Now listen to me. It's a real important truth. Whatever it is that you run to for your escape in one season can easily become your prison in the next. You realize that? The thing you run to that's your escape from your pain actually can turn out to become another prison that has you locked up and you actually aren't free. And we think we are, but we're self-medicating. We're just trying to figure out, and we don't know how to do it. Now listen, this, what I'm talking about, is not just a biblical truth. It's also a neurological reality. Can I just tell you this? This is how you're created. Now, I want to, you may know this if you've been around here, but I kind of love science a little bit. And I really like neuroscience, okay, which I'm not a neuroscientist. And so I talk about it, but I'm not an expert. I'm more of a neuroenthusiast, okay? I like stuff about the brain because I think it really helps explain some things about our behavior. And that to me is really helpful in understanding it. And so I was studying about the brain and addiction and how it works. And it just kind of opened my mind to understanding that none of us intend to be mastered by something. When you have an addiction, can I say this? It doesn't mean you're a bad person. We have this in our mind that someone's an addict. We got this picture that we paint, and oh, they did something totally wrong and bad. And listen, no one intends to be an addict. But I don't think we fully understand maybe the way God created us. Now, listen, you might be here and go, I don't know that I believe in God. That's okay. If we can differ on whether or not we believe that God wired or created us, designed us a way, or whether we just evolved to this, that is irrelevant. What our brain does is agreed upon. And so there's this little region in the middle part of your brain called the basal ganglia. The basal ganglia. In fact, that's such a fun term. Can we all say it out loud together on the count of three? I'm gonna teach you a little neuroscience, and hopefully I get it right. My doctor's in the room, so I always be careful. But all right, on the count of three, let's say basal ganglia together. One, two, three. Basal ganglia. Okay, I want to show you this little part in the middle part of your brain. The basal ganglia is a region of your brain that most would say, in simplistic terms, it's responsible for both reward and reinforcement. Okay, this is the part of your brain when you do something that helps you survive. See, your brain is designed to promote the things that survive, whether it's the survival of the species or it's just self-survival, and run away from the things that'll kill you, right? The whole hedonism. Run toward pleasure, run away from pain. Your brain is designed that way. And so here's what happens whenever you have something that is good for survival, like food. Food's good. Some foods are better than other foods. Some foods are really good, right? But whenever you have some good food, here's what happens. The taste receptors in your tongue send a signal to your brain going, I'm getting to eat. This is really good. And what your basal ganglia does is that it releases a chemical in the neurons of your brain, a neurotransmitter. One of the primary ones it does is called dopamine. There's other chemicals, but how many have ever heard of dopamine? Raise your hand. I think most of us have heard of dopamine, right? It's this little chemical, and here's what your brain's doing. Whenever you have something good that helps you survive, what's good that helps you survive? Food? Yeah. Social connections. Why? Because you're not intended, and people can survive better in groups, right? Social connections. Whenever you connect with people, it fires off. Procreation, sex, so good. It fires off, and so what happens is that your brain, because of the basal ganglia, it fires off, it tells the brain to fire off a neurotransmitter, which is this dopamine and other, serotonin, other things. And what it's doing is it says, I need this to survive. And, oh, by the way, you need to remember this because it's so good and it'll help you survive. So what does it do for reinforcement? Let me tell you what it does, is that it helps you form habits. Because it's so good. Dopamine, by the way, is known as the feel-good hormone. Because it creates a small little sense of pleasure, euphoria, when it gets released. And so because your brain's going, remember this, so you survive. Remember this, this is good, so you survive. What it's doing is it releases this chemical, and the chemical actually grows, and it can create a neural pathway. And by the way, it says, you should remember this, do it again, and every time you eat something, you smoke something, you drink something, you enjoy something, you are inside your brain, it goes, oh, that was good, do it again. And guess what? You do it again. That was good, do it again. You do it again. And guess what happens? You're actually changing the structure of your brain. And your brain's creating a pathway of neurons. It's literally growing it so that it reinforces that you do that to survive. Now here's the thing. Some of you know this because you've done some habits over and over so much that you don't even have to consciously think about it. You can just do it. Why? Because you've created a neural pathway inside of your brain. It's forming habits. This is what is commonly understood of this reward and reinforcement is something that we all practice. It's something that, honestly, this is something that we used to try to potty train our dog. You probably have done this before, but Harley, our dog, who's hanging on, barely, poor guy. But when he was a puppy, we didn't want him to go in the house. So we thought, let's train him. How do you train him? We would get them up, we'd take them to the back door. We always wanted to go to the same door. You want them to develop the habit. You're trying to form a habit, right? We go to the back door. We walk outside. We go out in the yard, and I'll just go, go potty. Go potty, Harley. You can do it. Go pee. Go potty, you know? And then when he would pee, we'd be like, yeah! You're reinforcing it, you know? You want him to know that you're excited. And then we come back in the house, and as soon as we come back in the house, we give him a treat. And so we go over to the pantry and open it up and we give them a treat. And what were we doing? Reward and reinforcement. Parents, we do this with our own kids, right? Go potty. You can do it. Go potty. Oh, you went poopy. Yay. Come get a treat. Right? Parents, we do this. Okay, we know this. It's reward and reinforcement. That's what we're doing, right? The bad thing is, I guess I never realized that Harley is not actually intelligent enough to understand that I was trying to give him a reward for going to the bathroom. What he figured out was I get a reward if I go outside. So every time he had to go to the bathroom, he would go to the door. Woo, get a treat. Even when he didn't have to go to the bathroom, he would go to the door and he would whine and we'd let him outside and he would turn right around and come back to the door. And as soon as I'd open the door, he would run over to the pantry and he'd go, are you going to give me a treat? Because what? Reward, reinforcement. It was actually creating a connection inside of his brain. It's the same way, maybe on a different level, for humans. Our treats are just different. In our household, our treats are donuts. We're donut people. Love donuts. Love donuts so much. By the way, did you know this? Sugar will cause your basal ganglia to go off and to release dopamine. It actually does. That's where they found a very addictive behavior with sugar, is because it's so good. We love donuts. And so we get donut. Donut was good. Next day, we need a donut because I don't feel as good as I did yesterday when I had a donut. Let's go to the donut shop. We get a donut. It's a reward, and we're just building this, reinforcing this behavior. But what we don't understand is that whenever we do that with our emotional pain and we run to an escape, what we're doing is we're creating a vicious cycle within ourselves and inside of our brains where we are no longer in control. That thing is. I have to have it. And food is one thing, and there's, you know, all different things that we turn, we're all different. But substances actually are on a whole nother level. You realize that, right? Like alcohol. So alcohol, when you drink alcohol, you have a few drinks. There's an initial kind of euphoria. There's a little bit of a buzz. You heard it say buzz? It's kind of like a stimulant first, you know. There's something about it that you feel a little bit better. And, you know, just like, oh, life feels good. But what you need to know is alcohol is actually a depressant. That doesn't mean, like, when you're depressed, you drink alcohol. That's not what a depressant is. It actually means that it depresses your central nervous system. It's an inhibitor. For all those neurotransmitters going off, it's actually an inhibitor that stops communication. And what it really does is it removes any sense or feeling. By the way, that's why a lot of people turn to alcohol when they're hurting. It's so they don't have to feel the pain. So I don't have to feel what I'm going, so I can forget. And the drink, if you drink enough, see, it gets in your bloodstream and it starts to affect different areas of your brain. And all of a sudden, that's where blackouts come from. This is where all these, it comes as a result. And so we don't even understand, but it's affecting the chemistry of our brains, right? Drugs, hard drugs, they on a whole nother level. See, hard drugs, not only when you do that, do a release of dopamine, that thing that's like a hit, but what hard drugs and opioids do in your brain is that it actually overactivates your neurons more than it ever should, which, by the way, is like, woo! People have this euphoric state or feel, but what it's doing is it's changing the chemical level and what is normal in your brain. So here's what it's doing. It's overactivating your neurons so much that after a while, your body starts to think that's normal. And when it drops down to what was normal, you just came off of something and you're actually miserable. And so what it does is it causes something in your body where you actually need to bring what was normal up to this state, which is why a lot of people start with one drug. Oh, it's just marijuana. It just makes it. And then it goes to another drug, and then it's never enough. It's because it actually is changing the chemistry in your brain. And this is creating a dependency and addiction. And the sad reality is, what first starts off as an escape quickly becomes a prison in your life that can destroy it. Today I want to share a story with you of someone who's part of our community that really has just gone through a journey of dealing with addiction. and all the fallout. And it really comes back to some things that happened in his childhood that really almost took everything away. Watch this.
Life for me from the very beginning was very chaotic, what I would consider to be anything but normal. I grew up with an alcoholic father who was very abusive to my mom and witnessed some pretty horrific things from the very beginning. And my dad was very, very abusive and taught us violence from a very young age. And that is how I would learn to cope with life, through violence and escape that came to be a model for me. We eventually were able to go underground, if you will, and move away from my dad many miles away. Basically started a new life, and that was in Southern Texas. For the first time in my life, I explored alcohol at the age of 12 years old and became intoxicated when I was 12 years old. And had this odd feeling that this is what I want. This is how I want to feel. And that would be a repetitive path that I would stay on for most of my life. I became a fighter. That was what I was known for. And part of that was what I learned from my dad growing up. When I was in high school, my mom came in one morning and told me that my dad had been murdered. He led a lifestyle he was in organized crime, and it finally caught up with him. This was a point in my life where I dug in even deeper in my addiction. I carried a gun to school and thought I needed to be somebody that I wasn't, and became this tough guy. There were times when, through the violence, I was stabbed twice, and it's pretty miraculous that, you know, I didn't lose my life. And there were times of sobriety, and then I would reach out to Christ and be involved in various programs at a very young age, and then I would go back out and do my thing. I ended up going to a Bible school in Texas and met someone there, and we ended up going out of state up north, and it turned into a very, very tumultuous relationship, and she became pregnant. I was still very absent and still continued to drink, and that marriage lasted all of about a year and a half. I was not a responsible father at all, and she witnessed my addiction from a very young age as well. And then I had a business opportunity to move out to Ohio and continue to drink and party, and the heavy drugs were pretty much gone at this point. I didn't really do heavy drugs anymore. I met someone here, and we ended up getting married. I had my second child, and again, we lived together, but I was a pretty absent father. Things progressed so bad through the drinking that it cost me a second marriage. Divorce happened, and I got into another very rough relationship. And then at some point, I realized that I couldn't be in this relationship anymore. And I decided to get out of it once and for all. And I met my wife, who I'm married to now. And things have been wonderful. At first, they were not. I carried a lot of some of those old behaviors into the relationship. And it was very damaging in the beginning. One day, I can't really explain it, but I was just tired of hurting people, and I didn't want to hurt anybody anymore. And I decided to get some solid help from some men of faith that surrounded me and get into programs, because we're not meant to do this alone. We're not meant to do life alone, much less addiction. And I moved forward, and that was November 7th of 2020 was my last drink. Through that, I was able to start repairing relationships. I was able to come alongside my daughter, was also having some struggles, and we began to rebuild a relationship that had been all but lost for many years. And I just saw a true freedom in her that she had really, really come to know Christ in a new way, and she had a freedom. And then March of this year, we received a call that she had passed away, and life for me changed, as they say. It was different. And for the first time in a while, I was walking through the airport and a drink sounded really good. I was transparent and just mentioned that to my wife. And fortunately, she's as strong as she is and was able to just have a conversation with me about that. And, you know, they say in recovery, play the tape through till the end. What's that going to look like? And I was able to do that. And I was able to not only avoid that drink, but gain strength in that time. It really changed the trajectory of my sobriety at that moment. As they say with alcoholism, one is too many and 100 is not enough. And that's how my life was. It didn't matter what I had in front of me. I always wanted more, or I wanted something different. I was just never happy where I was. Now I'm finding that joy. Even in the midst of the loss of our daughter, I'm finding joy in Christ that I've never had in my life. Yes, grief is overwhelming at times, but I know that God has his hand on my life, and this is the only way that I want to live for the rest of my life.
You know, there's really something powerful about hearing someone's story. I want you to note, and I'm grateful for the hope that Will has and what God's done in his life. But did you pick up on the theme? Emotional pain and not knowing how to deal with it led to an addiction that trapped him. And he has found freedom and is walking that out. And I want you to hear me today. There is freedom. There is health that we can move toward. And turning to our escapes, that's not freedom. That's enslaving. And I just don't believe that's the life that God has for us, the way God intended for us to live. And can I just say this? Self-medicating, it might feel like it's helping, but it's not healing and it's not hopeful. Whatever your thing is, I ask you, what's your escape? What is the thing that you run to? Maybe over and over, maybe in the middle of it right now. It won't actually move you toward health. And so as I was processing this and just knowing that this is a very real thing for all of us, I thought to myself, how do we find health? How do we move toward health when so many people are feeling such pain and going through that? And I want to give you a thought that I talked with a counselor. I said, this is what I see. This is what I feel like moves us toward freedom. And it's this truth about pain. And that is this, that pain is not to be avoided. It must be processed. Pain, yeah, I hope we get this today. This is not fun. We want to escape pain. Remember we talked about that? We'll run away from pain. We'll move toward pleasure. We end up trapped. Listen to me. If you want real freedom, if you want to move toward health and wholeness, pain is not to be avoided. It must be processed. And let me say it this way. It is not something you process alone. You do this with people. You do this in community. You do this with counselors. You do this with a therapist. If you need to, you do it with a doctor. You do it in a community of faith. But you do not do this alone. This is something we have to do together. This is something that, and I think it's so hard because most of us are ashamed of our pain. We're ashamed of our thoughts. We're ashamed of our hurt. You know what I'm praying that this series will do is it'll release us from that. That we can come out, we could just say, I'm struggling, I'm hurting. It's okay to not be okay. Please hear me that today. But if you want to move toward health, your pain, you got to process it. And I understand, listen, it's hard in a community our size that there are some of you that have wrestled with emotional pain, mental pain, for as far as you can remember. sometimes real. I have people who tell me in this church that I've struggled with anxiety, I've struggled with depression since the time I was a kid. And I want to encourage you, you get help, and you there are medications that can help. There are things that we can take. We need to do all of that. We really do. But don't overlook the power of a spiritual prescription in your life too. Let's not overlook the power of a spirit. I'm good there. We might need medical prescriptions. We might need counseling. We might need therapy. We might need all that. You might have an ongoing issue with that. But listen to me. There's also, I believe, some spiritual prescriptions that we can take that could actually maybe change our mind, move us toward health. And that is this. I want you to hear this. Freedom doesn't come from escaping. It comes from healing. And if there's someone I know that has the power to really touch and heal, it's God. It's the one who created us. Amen? Come on, stand up to your feet if you would. I want us, as I was kind of reflecting and I'm thinking, okay, God, I don't know how to address the wide scale issues that so many of us have. And I felt like God gave me this verse as kind of maybe a spiritual prescription that we can take. Again, this isn't to make it go away. For some, this will be a journey. Your whole life will be a journey of moving toward health and being cognizant of your weaknesses and your escapes and what you do and learning to put people and systems around you to help. Listen, it's not just sometimes you pray and it goes away. But I also don't want to overlook the power of a spiritual prescription, because David, I talked about David last week. David was a guy, I think, that wrestled with his mental health for probably most of his adult life. You read the Psalms, you see a guy who was struggling, who was hurting, who was emotionally hurting. And God brought to my mind this one Psalm that I've never forgotten. To me, it's a journal of his emotional journey. And in it, I think we find a spiritual prescription that David unleashed in his life. And sometimes it's something you have to do by faith, even if you don't feel it right now. Psalm 42, verse 5, this was David's mantra, I think. He said this, "Why, my soul, are you downcast?" He's having a conversation with his soul. Sometimes it's okay to have a conversation with yourself. He says, "Why am I so down?" He says, "Why so disturbed with me? I don't understand why I feel the tension and the stress, and I feel overwhelmed, and I feel despair, and I feel like I don't like myself, and I don't know if I can go on living. Why?" Sometimes we don't understand why. But then I love it. This is the prescription. It's not the only thing, but it is something. He says, "Put your hope in God." He says, "Put your hope in God." Say it with me. Put your hope in God. Listen, don't put your hope in a bottle. It'll become another prison. Don't put your hope in food because you're stressed. Don't put your hope in a drug. Don't put your hope in a relationship. Don't put your hope in social media. Don't put your hope in pornography. Don't put your hope in all those things. Put your hope in God. And then here's what he said. This is by faith, because you won't feel it. He says, "For I will yet do what?" Say it. I will praise him, my God and my Savior, my Lord. Here's the spiritual prescription. Most of the time when we feel pain, we reach for something to take. David says, "I'm not going to reach for something to take. I'm going to actually give something. I'm going to give praise to God. I'm going to put my hope in God. I'm going to trust in God. And I am going to begin to worship him even if I don't feel like it." You know, I think worship also can modify the brain. Did you hear me? There's some studies that actually show that when you pray, when you meditate, when you connect with God, that it actually begins to activate your brain. If there are other things that can activate your brain that can lead you into a prison, maybe there's something that can activate your brain that can actually bring some freedom, that can actually begin to bring health and healing in your brain. And so I thought maybe today, I don't know your situation, but maybe the spiritual prescription for us today, and putting our hope in God, begin to praise him. Turn your attention to him. Would you just bow your heads for a moment? I just want us to have a moment where we can just be honest with God in prayer. Father, I pray right now for every hurting soul in this place. I pray for everyone who is struggling specifically with their mental health right now. God, I know that you created us not to live entrapped, not to live enslaved by things that we run to that will escape from it. But God, here's what I know. I know you promised to meet us in our pain. And maybe that means going back and sitting in our grief. Maybe that means that we spend time in your presence, and little by little, there's more and more of a spiritual prescription of you giving us something that will address not the symptom, but the actual pain, the source of it. God, I pray that right now, that in this place, God, that we can learn to put our attention, God, not just to medicate, but to meditate on you as the hope for everything. God, that you are our hope. We don't put it in a false hope, but God, we put ourselves and our soul in you. We put ourselves in you as our true hope for healing, God.
Thanks so much for tuning into this message. I hope that it encouraged you and inspired your faith. If God is doing something in your life, would you take a moment and let us know? We want to connect with you, and we want to be able to pray for you. All you have to do is shoot us an email to hello@thex.church, or you can always send us a DM on one of our social media platforms. And if you know somebody that would also be encouraged by this very message, why not take a moment and just share it with them right now? And as always, I want to say thank you to every single person who so generously financially supports this ministry so we can continue to get messages like these out to people all over the world. We believe God is building something special, and you're a significant part of it. Until next time, have a great day.